It's hard to believe that we have been having in-depth weekly conversations about movies since 2011.
So many great conversations over the years about so many great movies. All that said, producing this show week after week requires a ton of work behind the scenes.
Becoming a Next Reel member gives you access to all sorts of additional and exclusive content. Plus, you're helping us keep the lights on. Just head to thenextreel.com/membership, where you can learn more about becoming a member, which costs a measly $5 a month, practically the same as one fancy coffee drink. And you get so much more.
Every month, we record a bonus episode exclusively for members. Those episodes cover movies from whatever series we're covering at the moment, or add to previous series.
Some movies we've covered that only members get to hear us discuss include The Blues Brothers,
The Russia House,
Naked Lunch,
Independence Day,
The Hot Rock,
and Relic, the better one. Plus, members get to vote on what we're going to discuss for those episodes.
We also record additional pre- and post-show content in regular episodes that only members get to hear.
Like conversations about similarly themed movies.
And answering listener questions from our live member chat.
Speaking of our live member chat, we record almost all of our episodes in Discord, where members can chat right along with us live.
Members get access to other members-only channels in our Discord community as well. On top of all that, members get all episodes a full week earlier than everyone else in a private Next Reel feed just for them that includes all the shows in the Next Reel family. The Next Reel, The Film Board,
Movies We Like, Sitting in the Dark, and more new projects on the way.
To top it all off, members don't have to listen to ads. We've already eliminated those annoying, dynamically inserted ads that, let's face it, we all hate it.
We are listening to you.
We love podcasting for a living, and those ads help to pay the bills. Now, we're counting on you, dear listener.
We promise. We aren't going back to those terrible, dynamically inserted ads that don't relate to us at all. All we ask is that you consider supporting the Next Reel family of podcasts with a membership.
Again, it's $5 per month or $55 per year. Just head to thenextreel.com/membership.
thenextreel.com/membership. Get your access to early, ad-free episodes with bonus content, member bonus episodes, and access to member channels and live streams in Discord by signing up today. I'm Pete Wright.
And I'm Andy Nelson.
Welcome to The Next Reel. When the movie ends,
our conversation begins.
The gray is over. I've stopped doing this world any good.
A job at the end of the world. I work security, protecting men from the dangers they cannot see. There's not a second goes by when I'm not thinking of you in some way.
Keep it moving.
We need a fire. Can we find food? If we don't move and work now, we're all freeze to death.
Somebody will find us.
They gotta know that plane went off the radar.
Nobody's gonna find us. Not here. We figure out what way is south and we start walking.
This will be one of those wild stories you tell at a party.
Liz, get up, get up. Yes,
sir. Don't move. Stare right back at him. Get to that tree line. We can better defend ourselves.
Here they come!
Go! Go!
Hold on!
You gotta be kidding me.
We can climb down.
If we follow the river, we got a better chance of finding shelter.
How are we gonna deal with this? We take them on, one at a time. I want to see your face, feel your hands and mine.
Don't stop!
That's kind of the vibe of The Gray. Like, it is an I give up movie. For most of this movie's vibe is I give up, right? Am I right?
Oh my goodness. You know, it's not I give up. It's like, I'm going to fight. Well, what's the point anymore? Like, yeah, it does kind of feel that way. But even to the end,
right.
Even to the end, he's trying to, you know, kick ass.
But okay. I had never seen this movie.
Oh, okay. Good.
You knew that.
I don't know if I knew that.
This is a movie I watched because of you. It's really good. I mean, it's a really good movie.
Yeah, I know.
I wanted to come in like hot, like, let me try and convince Andy that this movie is terrible, but it's really hard to do. It's terrible, but not because it's a bad movie. It's terrible because I don't care for it. I don't care for the environment. I don't care for anything. I watched it with my wife. She didn't believe the whole thing. Like, she didn't believe that they were in the cold. She didn't believe, because they were all wearing their clothes incorrectly. And so I started sending her text this morning as I was researching it about, well, they filmed on location on top of this stupid mountain and they nearly killed one another and it was too cold. And Carnahan saying, you know, I could have written something based in Tahiti fighting wild boars, but no, that never occurred to me. And so my wife says, I'm sure the cast members nearly died because they weren't wearing their clothing appropriately for the weather. No hats, hoods left down, coats open, and also falling in the water and then just continuing to walk through the snow is a recipe for death. She took it very, very seriously.
Wow.
And I think I might have ruined woods for her.
There's a lot of things going on in this movie. And yeah, they filmed this in Canada and in the snow. There are a lot of elements that were shot on stages, but they integrate it real well. A lot of it was just actually built in, you know, like the whole plane crash exterior they had on a field in Canada. It was really, really cold. And sometimes they did have to, like, Digital Domain did the effects and they had to add snow in. But Carnahan says, like, the day when they were filming, like, when Neeson wakes up in the snow right after the crash and his face is, like, you know, bright red.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, that was with the wind and everything. It was probably like minus 30 degrees outside. It was so cold. There was so much wind and snow blowing. And Neeson really is that cold. Like, he's freezing. The makeup lady would, like, rub snow on him and he would just, like, curse at her. He's like, this is miserable. But, like, to make all of these people, you know, really cold. And I mean, you know, I get the, maybe some of the frustration with the outfits and stuff, but at the same time, it's like, they were having to scavenge what had survived from plane wreck and, you know, going through suitcases and trying to find whatever coats or mittens or hats that they could. And I thought that they did a great job with that, of just kind of throwing together these different pieces of the outfits that they had. And I think that the blending of the real world where they were filming all of this and running through the woods and even the river, which Liam Neeson and Dallas Roberts both jumped into. They were both actually in that
river.
Icy cold river.
And the crew and the camera people. Like,
right,
they're in the river.
Right.
Yeah.
They're actually in the water. I mean, there's the part where Henrik is drowning and stuff, and that was done on a stage with, you know, in a tank and everything. But all of the actual, you know, falling through the water, trying to get each other and everything, was all in the river. They were actually in it. So it was, they were really doing everything they could to keep this as realistic as possible. And I think it shows.
Yeah, no, it totally shows. And it's surprising. It looks so good. It's unbelievable, right? It's a little bit Uncanny Valley winter. And I can totally see why Kira was like, I don't care for it. And it makes your brain, it forces you to question it because it feels so impossible. Like, it feels really impossible how beautiful it is. It also goes to how well it was shot. And I know we'll talk a little bit about it later, but it's so beautifully shot and so grainy, right? It feels almost a documentary, right? It feels so, like, naturalistic and filmic that it really does an able job of tricking my brain, right? I don't want to believe that they did this for real. I don't want to believe that this kind of situation exists. And that's the point of the movie, to put me in that space. And I think this movie does it exceptionally well. All the way to the wolves, which were real wolves, right? Like the wolves, sometimes. They trained sometimes real wolves. They had the real wolf. They had the alpha trained by a noted wolf wrangler. And so they did work with real wolves, which seemed like another thing that's awful about the wilderness.
Well, and there were this is a perfect example of using as many different ways of putting a story together as you can in order to craft something that is really effective. Like there are times where they're using real wolves. You know, Carnahan says the thing that the real wolves, because I mean, they're hard. You can't really domesticate a wolf and actually train it. But he said the things that they did really well is run from point A to point B. Like that was something that the wolves did exceptionally. Outside of that, it's hard to get them to do stuff. So there's a lot of CG wolves when they're like approaching the people and stuff and running at them and everything. And then they had some
puppetry.
And then they had some fantastic puppetry. Yeah, Greg Nicotero and his team at what's their company? KNB, I think, crafted a bunch of largely they were doing puppetry for wolf heads as they were attacking and biting and everything. Yeah. And so, but they, you know, they had a whole variety. And I think that Carnahan and his team found a smart way to put this together where they were actually capturing different pieces that felt, it's kind of like the Jaws storytelling where it's little bits and pieces that end up creating the picture in your head of this whole pack of wolves that's actually attacking these people. Like it's just incredibly effective.
Well, and here's the thing. Does it matter to you? Like when you think of this movie, and I'd never seen this movie again, and you were telling me, what is this movie about? Andy, what is the movie about to you?
Well, that's a really good question, because on the surface, it's a survival story. You have a group of seven men who are in a plane crash. They're the only survivors in the Alaskan wilderness, and because of wolf, like a nearby wolf pack, they can't stay at the wreck. They have to run and hope that they can get far enough away from the pack's territory where they won't get attacked anymore. And that's the essential plot of the story. But on top of that, there is so much of a philosophical look at the meaning of life, spirituality. Is there something? Is there a higher power? Just all of these different things about like, what is the purpose of living and everything. And I think that's what makes this film for me something so much more special. You know, it right out of the gate, it has a very kind of poetic start to the story as Liam Neeson's character Otway is reading this letter, or we're hearing him as he's writing a letter to his wife. And we kind of learn more in that story. He says that, you know, she left me a while back, and we just have a sense that, okay, she left him, but we don't really know much of the story. We find that out over the course of it, but we're just getting these hints that his past with his father, and his father was a poet or liked poetry. And he wrote this poem that becomes very kind of almost the motto in Otway's life, the way that he kind of this mantra as he's, especially when he's out here in the wilderness about trying to survive. And I think that's the thing that for me makes this film so much more special and exceptional than just another survival story.
Yeah, I think so too. He's, when we pick up the movie, he's already given up.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
He's already been beaten enough. And I think the movie in the open is incredibly efficient in building this world, right? That he is an incredibly isolated guy, and his job is taking life of wildlife, right? He just is there to kill wolves and bears and stuff, right? And keep them from invading the petroleum plant. And so he's already exhausted. His wife is gone. He's got nothing to live for. When the movie starts, right? Which is incredibly dour. Like that's so sad. Like you're already sad. And the rest of the movie is putting him in an even worse situation where he has to continually question, why am I still here? What do I have to live for? And every one of the other men on that plane who survive have that same question. Like, why are they there? What are they living for? What are they going back for? And what causes them to take the next step? All the way up to the point at the very end where Diaz has to you know, finally has that clear-headed, that first sort of clear-headed conversation where he says, you know what, I don't have anything left to live for. I really don't. I'm done. And watching somebody make that choice is an incredibly powerful moment in this movie. It's incredible. So I think all the way to the very end, and I did not know until I turned it off. I didn't get to the post-credits bit. Mm. And so I watched that this morning.
You don't need it. It's not like a hint at what's to come. It's just, it's really interesting if you see it, but if you missed it, it's like you're not missing too much. You know, to that end, I enjoy that little beat.
Well, so I agree with you. It does influence how to think about that very question of why do you keep going, right? Like, there is something at the end of this movie where everybody else is gone and Neeson is alone with this alpha wolf who's been stalking him.
Yeah.
The last cut is a cut to black as they charge one another. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's it. And then the movie is over. And you don't know how the fight goes. I think watching the fight would have been way too much.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Although a lot of people were very upset that we didn't get to see that. That was a weird contention that, like, audiences seem to feel they deserve in movies like this.
Hmm. Well, boy, that post-credit scene does not help. Because here they are. They're fighting one another. He makes the choice to fight. Like, he chooses to stand up for himself, right? So, like, the fight that he's been putting up for the entire duration of the movie to stay alive for some reason when he was already suicidal, it's like he won that in himself. And now he's going to fight this last battle. And I don't really have a good answer for why he's chosen to do that, but the fact is that's where he is. And now he's fighting nature directly by hand, or also with little tiny airplane bottles and a knife. And then it cuts to black, and the final beat is him and the wolf together, kind of a close-up shot on their shared hair, the hair on his head and the fur on the wolf, just breathing. To me, I am equally conflicted, but no longer why do they choose to fight, but are they just lying together to die together, or somehow did they tame each other and they're lying in exhaustion? Like, you can kind of find a hint of optimism in the end that I don't think you necessarily get without seeing that last beat. I found a hint.
I don't know if I felt it that way. I think I go back to that moment in the beginning of the film when he shoots that wolf that's charging the men in the field, and he goes up to that wolf as it's dying, and you just have it kind of like those slow last breaths, and he just kind of rests his hand on it, almost as if in a way to kind of comfort it in its last moments of life, you know? And I think that last moment that we have at the very, very end of the credits is akin to that, where now it is this moment where the two of them are dying, and in a weird way, it's like they're comforting each other. The only, like, the two alphas essentially are the only ones who could effectively comfort each other in that moment of death that they're sharing, you know? And I think that's, and especially paired with the poem that his father had written that he kind of recites a few times, "Once more into the fray, into the last good fight I'll ever know, live and die in this day, live and die in this day."
Yeah.
I think that that's, for me, that's the only way I can read that last bit is the last good fight either of them would know, and they both fully lived and are dying on this day. Like, that's the way I read it.
I agree with you. And I'm really just making a case because I also think that they're lying there to die. And I think that live and die line is really important because not to lean too heavily on the metaphor, but that's exactly what happened in that last bit, right? They lived in the fight and died together on that day. And I think that's man, what an incredible downer that is. But also, like, it's kind of a story of a guy who finds his purpose.
Right, yeah. And I think that's, again, why it's so strong. And you know, he, to a certain extent, finally kind of heeds his wife's dying words, which were, "Don't be afraid." And it seems like up until this final bit, he had kind of been living a life in fear, like, what do I do? I'm going to run away from the world and I'm going to hide up here in the Arctic and shut myself off from everything. And that kind of became who he was. And he's suicidal. Like, he's clearly a very depressed person who just has not been able to come to terms with things. Through this entire plane crash, it's like he finally has been able to find his purpose again. You know, it's that drive to survive. Would he have still been there if, in fact, he did survive at the end of this movie? Like, or did that matter? Maybe it's the top falling at the end or spinning at the end of Inception. Like, it doesn't matter whether he actually is rescued at the end of this or dies fighting the wolves. He has actually found his purpose again, and he has made it through the depression that he had been in and was able to move forward. So even though it is a very dark, kind of depressing end because all of our characters die, I still find this sense of positivity in the story, because it ends in a person finding their own peace with the world. Several people. I mean, I think I wouldn't say Dallas ended up in that particular place under the water, but certainly Diaz, I think, very much ends up in that place where he realizes where things are. And that's why Frank Grillo in this, like, this watch, it's just like, what a performance. Like, it's just really amazing watching his character transform. And, you know, in a group of incredible performances, I think it's easy to see why Frank Grillo and Liam Neeson were largely the two who were singled out.
All three of those guys at the end together, Dallas and Grillo and Neeson, as they are sharing their first names for the first time. That was a moment of such incredible vulnerability and intimacy between these three guys on screen. Like, it was like, it sort of takes your breath away a little bit watching them kind of reveal this thing that just because of what masculinity and culture, they had never said to one another. That was really incredible.
Well, it is an interesting group of men. I mean, they are working at this oil refinery in northern Alaska, far from the rest of the world. And Otway says in his letter, it's like, this is a group of criminals, like people who had been inmates at various points in their life, can't get any other work. And this is where they come, to the end of the world, just to, because this is the work that they can get. So it's very rugged ex-criminals. And that's the sort of people that they're working with. And I think they're trying to figure out how to survive, but a lot of them have families. Like when Talgett's talking about his daughter and everything, you get this sense that the work that he can get as an ex-con is at this oil refinery in Alaska, and he rarely gets to see his daughter. And when he does, he can tell because how long her hair has grown.
Yeah.
And you get these interesting impressions of these people trying to make life work again, and in the only way that they can. And it makes for this fascinating community of people who are very closed off and aren't going to be that willing to open up. And I mean, when the first time we see most of these people, it's in this rowdy bar up there. Diaz and his buddy Hernandez are going at each other in a bar fight, even though they're friends, that we see them later. And so it's just like this really rugged group of people. And like, seeing the fact that they finally have this moment of kind of acknowledging that and that first name bit, I mean, it's just, it really is a sense of that opening up.
So who's the, we have a Private Ryan level death in the first death on the plane after the crash, the bleed out death.
Yeah. That's James Badge Dale's small part that he has in this.
Yeah. What'd you think of that?
It's a powerful moment in the film. I mean, we haven't even talked about the plane crash. We have to, at some point, we'll step away from this and talk about that, because that is a stunning, stunning work. James Badge Dale has a very small part in this, but it's a critical one, because it really shows us who Otway is and just the way that Otway handles these situations in a very realistic way. But also, in a certain sense, Otway is really setting up the philosophy of the film in that conversation he has with Lewenden, is James Badgedale's character's name, as he is dying. And he's like, he's telling him, you're dying. This is what's happening. Who do you love? You think of them, let them take you there. And it's a moment of giving somebody who's dying that way to find acceptance in what's going to happen. And we don't see who it is who Lewenden is seeing in that moment, but we're with him as he's dying.
Because it doesn't matter.
Oh, what a heartbreaking, like that is one of the hardest things to watch in this film. It's just done so perfectly, but it gives us a sense of how Otway handles all of this. And then from there forward, like there are times where we have these, like we see it with Burke. We don't get into his head, but he's got that moment where he wakes up and he's seeing his sister who died when he was a little kid. And that's who's taking him out there. The hardest one for me to see is Talgott, when after he falls from the trees and he sees his daughter standing over him and she does the thing with her hair and it just like rips your heart out. And then it cuts to the reality of the wolves like digging into him as they're ripping him to pieces. Oof.
And dragging him off. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Well, this is the way I wanted to talk about Lewenden's death first, because I want to give such like massive credit to Carnahan and Ian McKenzie Jeffers writing this thing, because this is a great opportunity to watch writing masks really, really well. Like all of these guys, they set up their public kind of persona, their identity, the masks that they all wear of being these giant tough guys in the bar. They're fighting each other. They talk to each other in horrible ways on the planes. The plane, the masks start to lift off because you start to see them a little bit scared. But by the time we have this interaction where, you've got guys who are trying to save Lewenden, and finally when Otway comes up to him and has that conversation, the masks are off, both in the form in Otway, who is this just clear-eyed, truth speaker, and in Lewenden, who accepts it and adapts and realize, and you get to go through in his eyes, you get to go through the fear and uncertainty and terror and then acceptance as you watch him die, as they look at each other in the eyes, and everybody around them, all of these tough guys, are suddenly, they're suddenly broken, right? Because they bore witness to something so powerful. And I think that happens so early in the movie to reset expectations for who these people are, that it is just such an incredible example of expert character pivot that is believable and draws you in to these guys who, when you start out, as you said earlier, you don't want to be attracted to any of them. There's no charisma for any of them. You hate them all. And suddenly you have to like them again because you realize they're human.
Aside from all of that, which is all absolutely true, it also is an interesting moment in a story about packs. Like we've got this wolf pack outside, but essentially we also have this pack of humans who are the survivors of these seven men who have made it. And it is also a way where Otway starts essentially kind of setting himself up as the alpha, right? Like he becomes the alpha of their group. And shortly after this, he's outside and he sees what he thinks is another survivor and goes over to them, only to see that it's actually a wolf feeding on a dead body. And then he's attacked by a wolf and they have to fight off this wolf. And it's after he, as the alpha, is attacked, that's when Diaz kind of starts coming at him. Like, Diaz wants to be the alpha and wants, like, why are we all following this guy? Like, Diaz becomes such a perfect antagonist for Otway through so much of the film that I think that's what makes it so interesting, is the way that you have this kind of this comparison between the two different packs, as they're for you have different elements vying for dominance within, and also them battling each other.
So, okay, the plane crash.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Don't fly it again. Because do you think this was a Boeing plane? I don't know.
Or Southwest. Either way.
just pieces start falling off. That's what they don't tell you. It looks like it's just a like it's weather related. It's not, just pieces fell off.
Yeah, right. Oh, there's sparks up in the cabin. Yeah. I don't know. There's something going on in this plane. Holy cow.
Yeah.
It's so effectively crafted because it starts shaking. You're like, you're going through turbulence at some point. And Flannery is like just the perfect, like Joe Anderson plays Flannery, and he's just the perfect ass that you just don't want on a plane, because he's like, you know what you shouldn't do is stick your head between your legs if we're going down. And like, he's saying all the stuff that you don't want people to be saying. And like, he plays it so well. And you think, okay, the plane's about to go down. But then we cut to the flight attendant as she's just kind of going through the aisles and checking on everything. And okay, we've made it through that. But then it just, but then it starts building. And like, everybody's breath is really cold. Like, you see that fantastic shot of all the breath just kind of in the cabin. And the screen with the map where their travel flight path is starts kind of flickering, and you're like, okay, something is awry. And then this is where we start kind of having those moments with Neeson where he's having these dreams of his wife, and we don't really know, like, the way that they piece the story of the wife together is really subtle. But you have this moment where she, like, they're under a sheet, like, it's all white, they're under a sheet, and you have her kind of like stroking his face and everything. And then suddenly, like, he is like ripped up out of the bed, and it's like a jolt that wakes him up, and suddenly he's like, what's going on? And that's when things really start getting shaky in the cabin, and that's when the sparks start flying up in the front, and sure enough, the whole thing starts going down, and it's intense. Like, half the plane rips off. That shot of his face as he is like, he's such a smart person, the way that he's got one seatbelt on, but seatbelts himself with the second one to brace himself. And you've got the landscape because the side of the plane is gone, and you just see the snow and the trees like getting closer and closer. It's just like, it's a really, really frightening plane crash.
Oh my God, it's awful. It's just awful. And so, incredible shout out to, the camera, Masanobu Takayanagi is extraordinary, but the choices to put the camera on Neeson's face and let the terror be revealed in the mask out above him as the trees go by is extraordinary. It's just pitch perfect terror framing. Because you just know and it's also quite efficient, right? And probably much less expensive.
We stay in the plane the whole time.
It's really, really great. And so it's great. And also the cutting, like just editing those pieces together when he is ripped up, like you say, from the sheet, that happens a number of different times in the movie to make those transitions from his head life to real life. And it's flawless. I mean, it's just flawless.
Yeah, like, right, because right after the crash, that's the second, one of the other times we get when they're together, and suddenly it's like he is pulled horizontally away from her, or she's pulled horizontally away from him, however you want to see it, but then suddenly, like, he sits up, and he's in the snow, like, there's snow everywhere, and that's, like, when he comes to in a snowbank, essentially, after the crash.
Do you know how they did that?
They had him on a dolly, and then they pulled him away from her, and then they speed ramped it to kind of, and then they added, I think they added the snow effects in with digital domain.
Man, that is, it's one of those things that you can kind of see going either way. It just looks like such a beautiful practical opportunity to just throw the actors around and do something right. Because it makes it look better when he's got weight to him because he's actually being tossed around. And
right.
God, it looks just so good. Yeah. So good.
It's a flawless plane crash in film. Like, there are a few that work exceptionally well, and that's one of them. It's just
whew. Yeah, well, and it's one that it's been around long enough that's a plane crash that I had seen, and so that was not the crash itself was not a surprise. How they got to it, like, I think you undersold that cut from the turbulence to the flight attendant walking to the aisle.
Yeah, it's very quiet,
just
peaceful.
Really jarring, calm before the storm. And I just keep thinking, like, you just can't help but think, how is this plane broken? Because there's no way they should be seeing there. Like, your brain is like, did they already crash? Are they already in the snow? You know, what is it that is making their breath like that? The plane is broken. They must have already crashed. And then you get, they go down. Oh, God, it's perfect. It's perfect. It's a roller coaster. It's perfect.
Yeah, truly. It's a frightful one. Very, very intense.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, back to our different characters as they're dealing with the wolves. You know, we deal with Luenden first, and then they have to figure out how are we going to survive. It's not just surviving at the plane. I think initially, I don't know, I've always heard, like, if you're in a situation like with this, stay with the crash because you're more likely to be found because it's this huge thing on the ground that likely will be seen more than a few people walking through the snow. It seems like initially they're going to, like, they try to stay, but right away, like that first night, they already have wolves outside attacking, scavenging the dead bodies. They don't have any food. And Otway kind of has this thing that, like, these wolves are here. They're just going to keep coming. They know we're here. We're in their space. We got to go. Now, I think it's an interesting element that Otway, potentially the person who knows the most, also is just a human trying to figure stuff out without realizing it, ends up leading them deeper and deeper into the actual wolves' territory until eventually he's at the den. And I think that right. is like such a sad part of the story is, like, this is this person who theoretically is the expert and everyone's trusting him, and he's just inevitably making it worse and worse for them
with
the
every
whole time.
Step. Yeah. Yeah, it's not yeah. great. It's not great, but it's actually, I mean, that makes... It makes the movie more sort of, to me, more believable because, of course, that's what could happen. That I'm just in it by then. By the time he loses them, loses all of his friends and is sitting in the middle of the den. And it almost, I mean, it's almost funny.
In one way, you could see that that way, I suppose. That's a dark bit of humor, but
yeah.
Well, just running through the cast real quick,
sure.
In order of death, I suppose. Ben Bray plays Hernandez. He is the number seven. He's the one who dies first. He's on night watch, and he decides to pee, and he steps away from the camp, and of course, that is what kills him. Ben Bray is also the stunt coordinator on the film, and he's, I think, somebody that Joe Carnahan has used a number of times, and he's definitely a prominent name in the world of stunt coordinating, has done a lot of big films, and I think he works well as an actual performer here. I mean, he dies first, so it's not as big of a part, but he's like the first one first when Otway comes to, the first person he finds is Flannery, who's bleeding and freaking out. But Hernandez is second, and he's the one who's like, what is going on? And like really genuinely kind of terrified in this moment of like, what the heck? And he's the one who starts helping him. And, you know, I just think for a stunt coordinator, I think he delivers a pretty solid small part here.
I do too, and it's a neat part. It's also a good gory part because, you know, this is before, like, we've already seen the death of Flannery, so that had weight to it. But then we get into the just like the action deaths, and, you know, of course he steps away to pee and he's killed while peeing. Like that's that's like, of course he would go that way. But we get a good kind of a good gruesome kind of growly attack and drag away and rip apart, and so that's great. As they die, they become more and more meaningful.
Yeah,
right. They build in kind of weight.
Yeah, absolutely. Hernandez is number seven. Number six is Flannery. Joe Anderson plays him, and he's one of those characters that you love to hate in this film. An interesting actor. He is also, you know, in a film that we've talked about how much we adore, The Ruins.
Yep.
He's in that film too, a British actor that he works well here. He's the one who is on the plane that everybody is like, he's too much. Right out of the gate, he's already too much for Otway because he sits next to Otway and won't shut up. And then when Otway says, look, I don't want to talk, I just want to lay here, he gets up in a huff and goes off. It's just, he's great. But he gets killed as they're fleeing for the woods, and he's already been injured, and so he's trying to keep up but can't. And, you know, he's that one who gets picked off by the wolves. Very sad.
Yeah, gross.
And we should just, a nice touch, I think, is the idea for Otway to kind of collect the wallets of people so that they can, you know, if they do make it out, they can deliver them to family and everything.
Right.
Yeah.
Before Diaz loots them all. What an awesome conflict that was, right?
That was a great bit, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but they get down into the woods, and that's where Burke is struggling. He's been having a hard time coughing a lot. Nonzo Anozie plays Burke, and I most remember him right now from Sweet Tooth, because he is Big Man in Sweet Tooth, which is a show that we're watching with the kids and having a lot of fun with. But he's been around quite a while, and I do enjoy him quite a bit.
He's a Ted Lasso guy, too.
Oh, is he?
He's a dad of one of the players, and
gotcha.
Really, really great. And but he's been around for a long time. It doesn't feel like it feels like a long time. It's really the 2000s, but he's just been one of those faces. He's really hard to miss, and so I feel like he's just a face I see in stuff all the way back to like Rock and Rolla. And
Happy Go Lucky, yeah,
yeah, right. So neat. Oh, and Game of Thrones. Of course.
Who's he in Game of Thrones?
He's a Game of Thrones guy. Jaro Joan Daxos.
Oh, I don't remember who that is.
It's he was an early character, but it was a season two. But one of my favorite episodes is the last episode he was in, Valar Morghulis. And so, yeah, well, anyway, we could go on to Game of Thrones. It's not a Game of Thrones podcast, but he's in it and he's great.
Yeah, he's great, and he delivers well in this part. And he has the quietest of the deaths. It's really kind of like almost in your sleep sort of death. And in the morning, as they're trying to, they're slowly getting up. They just can't revive him, and it's just like when I see the shot of the snow on his face and like in his eyes,
yeah,
that just kind of really creeps me out. It's really a freaky death.
Yeah.
So that's 765. So number four is Talgott, Dermot Mulroney. We've got a really fantastic sequence where they come up on a cliff, and the only way to get, they can't go back because of the wolves. And so they have to figure out how to get down. And Henrik, they tie a bunch of pieces of clothing together to Henrik, who runs and jumps across and manages to actually
survive
and catch himself in a tree, and then ties it off so that they can slowly start making their way over. And Diaz makes it over, and Otway makes it over, and Talgott, who's afraid of heights, is doing okay. And then his glasses fall off, and then his boot catches on a piece of one of the knots and rips it, and the whole rope falls, and he hits the tree, and boom, boom, boom. Like, that is a really jarring sequence. Like, watching him fall through the trees, it hurts. It hurts to watch that sequence.
So bad. And lands on his neck.
And it's Mulroney. Like, you don't want that to happen to Mulroney.
I know. There was a part where they make it, it's such a dramatic moment that when he loses his glasses, they fall down into the river below. Like, there's not a small part of me that says, oh, well, man, that was pretty dramatic. Maybe you should just let go. You lost your glasses. Maybe it's just not worth it.
It's time. It's time.
Maybe that's a sign. Take it as a sign. Release. You're fine. Let it wash over you.
You'd be the like worst. You're worse Neeson. Than Otway.
Yeah. That's Otway on the fire break. It will wash over you. Let death wash over you. You can't see. You're a burden to yourself and others.
I was questioning, like, why are they getting onto the rope, like, feet first? So their feet are pointed the direction they need to go. That seems so much more difficult.
So much more work.
I'm speaking as if I've climbed down onto ropes off of cliff edges before. I have a feeling part of it is like, you just get your body onto it in whatever way works the quickest because you're terrified. And so I imagine there's a lot of it to that, but I would try my best to get my hands facing the way I'm going so that I can at least pull myself more easily. Yeah.
For me, it's video game logic. So I know in a video game, when you run up to something you have to either balance on or crawl across, you really just get in the general area and then drop, and you'll magically hook onto it. So that's kind of what I was hoping for in this movie, that he would just kind of fall into the ravine and then be on the rope and everything would be fine. That didn't happen.
Right.
So miserable.
But I tell you, the way that this, they shoot that whole thing, like when you have this cliff and you've got I think it was Otway when he gets on, because he's debating, like, do I go first or do you go first? And Talgott is afraid of doing it because of the heights. So Otway's like, fine, I'll go. And you get that shot, and he kind of goes out of frame, and then the camera just kind of slowly comes until it's like looking straight down, and you're just like, ugh, it's like so vertiginous looking off of that ledge as they're climbing on that rope. Like it's very effective and very creepy. And I guess they filmed a lot of that, like with the whole backdrop and everything, they were just in a parking lot, just filming all of that. And they just added all of it in later.
Yeah, that was great. That's terrifying. The only thing I think we don't get in this movie, and I'll say in our pre-show, we talked about Lost in the Woods movies. One of my picks is The Mountain Between Us. And that is the one terror that I have in these kind of Winter Wilds movies that we don't get in this one. They do jump in the river, but they know the river is there, right? The terror is when they're walking on a surface that they don't know has some sort of water below it. Like they're walking on a frozen lake and they don't know it's there and somebody falls through. That's like peak Arctic terror moment for me. And we don't get that in this movie. I was actually kind of surprised that we didn't get anybody falling through an icy lake.
Falling through ice.
Yeah.
Well, they can't squeeze all of the tropes in.
Choices must be made. That's right.
So we're down to three. We've got Diaz, Henrik, and Otway. And Diaz had fallen out of the tree and hurt his ankle. And this is that moment of peace that he's walking. They've made it to the river. They're walking along the shore, but Diaz is really struggling. And he sits down and he has that moment of clarity, as you said. And Frank Grillo is somebody that I've enjoyed often enough. I generally think of him in the Marvel movies. Turned up in the Captain America storylines and was a lot of fun in those films. And that's kind of where I go to with him, but he's done a lot of stuff. And I guess I don't think of him as the person who's going to be delivering a moment like this. This moment where he has this moment of clarity and this moment of peace, and he's having that final beat here, I think says so much about who he is as a character, and that for him at this point, it's just easier to just sit here and welcome death. And it is one of the most heartbreaking moments, like in a film that has a number of them. I mean, just watching him come to terms with that and then just sit there and he's staring at this magnificent backdrop and you just hear the wolves slowly starting to come. And he's just got that last line, like, don't be afraid, or like, whatever. It's something akin to what Otway's wife keeps saying. And what a moment.
The moment is amplified so much because of Henrik. Like Henrik coming to terms with the, wait, you're not allowed to do what you're doing. You can't just choose to stop living. You can't do that. You're not allowed. And that, I think, that pairing is just really great. Dallas Roberts gives that extra weight, being able to kind of weigh that ethical sort of moral compass against Grillo's, choice.
Well, and I think that speaks so much to what Henrik said up at the top before he makes the leap to the trees. He's just like, I don't think that this is my time. Like, I feel like there's a lot more for me to do. Like, he has a different viewpoint on the world. And he's just like, I am not going to die here. This is something that I have to get through, but I have more to do. And for that worldview to come butting heads with Diaz's at that transition, like, that is kind of like a breaking point that Henrik just wasn't expecting. And yeah, it makes for fascinating conflict of the characters there.
For sure. For sure. Meanwhile, Otway is just like, okay, I get it.
Let it wash over you.
Yeah, let it wash over you. Let it wash over you.
Yeah. It's really fascinating. But at the same time, what was interesting about watching Otway there, because we do have, it's shot so simply, and that's something I don't know how much of it was, obviously a lot of the choices were Carnahan's, but I think also paired with his cinematographer. Like, it's several just shots of, like, you've got a really wide character shot of the three characters as they're having the conversation, and that holds for quite a while. Eventually we get a reverse of them from the other direction, but it's still just a wide three shot. And I think we only cut in to to Otway at one point in that. And it's not even that close of a close-up shot, but there's an interesting element to him as a character that it's just like, I wish I could get to that point. Like, it's like he had been at that point. You know, we have that conversation with Henrik late, just moments later, about how the only time he had seen that look on Diaz's face before of the accepting death is when he saw Otway's face in the bar right before he was about to kill himself. And it's like Otway has passed that point now and can't get back to that place. And so there's an interesting element to him there.
Yeah. Yeah. Really interesting. And I think that's a great point, that he's now almost come too far to give up. Right. Like that's that experience. It's amazing.
Right, right, right.
And then we go back to, like, now we've built up a lot in Henrik, right? We've built up a lot in this character, and we kind of learn to love what he's kind of stands for in the group, and we lose him in just a horrible, horrible way.
It's the hardest, I think, because, I mean, you know, the wolves and everything, we know that they're coming, but to be in the water and just to have your ankle get stuck in a rock, and he's inches away from the surface, and they just, like, he can't get out. Otway can't pull him out. It is one of the hardest things to watch, because it's like you're so close, but it's far enough where you just can't get out of it. It's so painful to watch that.
Yeah, it is a really well architected horror scene.
Yeah, especially after they've come through as much as they have. You know, I mean, they just escaped some wolves that were chasing them, and they got away in the water, only to have this happen. Like, it's terrible.
Bad thing.
It's a bad, bad thing.
Okay, Liam Neeson.
Yes. We've talked in our pre-show, we mentioned Neeson and his exceptional amount of film activity in the 2010s. I think we were counting, just in narrative features, it's in the 30s, close to 40 in all of the projects that he's been in. It's over 60 just in the 2010s. It is a huge number of projects that he just keeps busy with. And a lot of it is, you know, pretty low quality, but clearly he's doing it just to keep busy. But then you have moments like this that pop up. And it's Liam Neeson. I mean, Academy Award nominated actor. We know he's great. We love Liam Neeson. We also know he knows how to kick ass, and he's got a special set of skills in all of, like, the Taken films. Like, he knows how to perform a variety of different things. And I think this is such an interesting opportunity to kind of blend a number of the different skill sets of his.
I have learned not to poke fun at the choices that actors make because of the Bruce Willis effect.
Yeah.
But you have to see some parallels in some of the caliber of choices that Liam Neeson has made. Some, not all, but there was a time where it just felt very paychecky.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
And I think that time still is happening. Like, I still feel like when I see some of the trailers for some new movies of his, I'm like, well, he's still, like, I mean, in the pre-show chat, you were talking about Ice Road. Did you know that they're in pre-production on Ice Road 2, Road to the Sky? Like, he still is making those.
Yeah. Did you know he is slated to play Frank Drebin in the Naked Gun reboot in 2025? How about a movie that doesn't have a poster yet for 2025 called Cold Storage from Johnny Campbell? You know, extinction level destruction, blah, blah, blah. Everything's cold. There's a lot of cold in Neeson's thing. And yet, sometimes those movies really pay off. I would have bet money that Taken would have been crap. And I really enjoy Taken, right? Yeah, set off the kind of retribution dad films, right? Like, I really enjoy Taken. I enjoy how it works as an action movie. And then he did two more Taken movies, and The Commuter, and Ice Road, and The Marksman, and Honest Thief. And I don't know any of those other movies besides Ice Road, which is terrible.
Cold Pursuit, I enjoyed that, but it's a remake, and the original is maybe a little more interesting than the reboot or the remake.
Yeah. So it's interesting. He is an actor who is so prolific and has done such a variety of things, but he's also such an iconic presence that he's easy to kind of lampoon himself, and has played dramatically so many incredibly iconic roles that, you know, that it's easy to have a certain set of skills, right? Like, yeah, I mean, right. Come on.
Well, even taking that kind of caricature of himself into Bad Cop in the Lego movie, yeah. Like kind of,
right.
Yeah. Acknowledging that about himself.
He certainly knows it. Yeah. I mean, he certainly knows it, but to also be, you know, the guy from Schindler's List and the guy from the Star Wars movies and the guy, like he's got an incredible catalog. There's just a lot to be proud of for what he's done. 2000s are rough selection, but man, he's got a lot going.
But he delivers. Like, you see what he gives you in this film and you go, oh, this is why he gets cast so much, because he can carry the action off, but he's also delivering on a very high level, a really compelling character that is equally heartbreaking and a little bit of a kind of an ass and just a little gruff, but also, you know, like the action star. Like, there's so much going on with this character that I find so interesting. And we finally get to the end and we recognize what actually happened with his wife. Like, it's just as heartbreaking as some of those scenes like that we had with Talcott and everything. And lest we forget that incredible moment that we have with him and the wallets at the end, as he's kind of saying goodbye to all of the people that he had been with, and he's looking at their personal photos and remembering them for who they were, and almost doing his own version of what Henrik wanted to do at the plane crash before they left, of actually like saying a prayer. Like, this is kind of Otway's own version of that, of saying goodbye to these people. He makes this little pile of wallets saying goodbye to everybody. The hardest one for me to watch is Diaz's, because Diaz doesn't have any pictures of family or anything. It's just him. He's just a loner. And Neeson just kind of holds his wallet in his hands and just kind of clasps it between them, almost like in a prayer.
Yeah.
And then just saying goodbye to all of those people. I mean, it's just, that is like, he doesn't have much to work with there, but Neeson is delivering on just all cylinders at that point.
Totally. Totally. God, the guy is capable of so much. There's another one that I haven't seen. Did you ever see Mark Felt? 2017?
No.
I think it's the first movie made after it was revealed that Mark Felt was Deep Throat. And so it's the other side of All the President's Men, right? And he plays Mark Felt, but the cast is incredibly stacked. Diane Lane, Tony Goldwyn, Michael C. Hall, Tom Sizemore, Bruce Greenwood, Noah Wiley, Eddie Marzan. Like, it's an incredible cast, and it seems like it should have been better than it is. Not very many people giving it 5 stars, but it looks like a good middle of the road, but awesome political drama. And you can totally see Liam Neeson playing a character like this. Like, I get it. And what great opportunity for him to play these kind of historical figures.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
No, I mean, I think that he's one of those people who just is so busy doing stuff that you kind of lose track of what's actually getting made by him. But certainly is somebody that I think, you know, it might be worth looking through the 2010s and just saying, okay, what are the good ones that like 6 stars and above on IMDb that I should be checking out? Cause maybe there's more in there that I just am missing because he's just been so busy.
Oh God. Why can't I remember the name of it? The rest of the movie that we just talked about, it, the sword fight. It had the awesome sword fight at the end.
In the 90s that he did. It was
Almond. What was it?
It also had him leaping into water. Rob Roy. Yes.
Rob Roy. Yeah. I kept wanting to call it Loch Lomond.
Yeah. Fantastic sword fight in that film.
Yeah.
He's great. That's a great film.
He's so good.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Where do you stand with Joe Carnahan? He's the writer director taking the short story written by Ian Mackenzie Jeffers, Ghostwalker, and working with Ian to craft this script. Joe Carnahan, definitely an action director who what is he most known for? Is it Smoke and Aces? Kind of the one that
I think Smoke and Aces.
I think Narc is where he kind of came to popularity. And I loved Narcos. It was a fantastic film that he did in 2002. But then Smoke and Aces seems to be the one that, I don't know, people associate more with kind of like the Carnahan, like crazy level of kind of comedy, yeah, action. Like he brought a lot of interesting things to that. I haven't seen it, but I know that's one that he's that is mentioned with his name a lot.
Well, and you know, my favorite, the BMW commercial movies.
Oh, yeah. Love those.
The Hire and Ticker he directed. And those were great. Those were great. So it's funny, you know, I've seen the A-Team. I've seen now The Gray. Never seen Those Who Kill or Stretch. Watched a couple episodes of The Blacklist, but not the ones he directed, I'd wager. Not seen Boss Level or Battle Ready or Cop Shop. Like, it's funny to think that, like, I know Joe Carnahan, but I guess by reputation first. And I enjoyed, like, so Smoke and Aces, that was Ryan Reynolds was in that one. Is that right? That was a pre-Marvel Ryan Reynolds?
Yeah, I think that was Ben Affleck, Andy Garcia, Ryan Reynolds, Ray Liotta, Peter Berg, Jeremy Piven, and Common was in that. Yeah, it was a lot. It was like a bunch of different groups coming together to go after a snitch.
Well, that seems like a thing we should see, because I haven't seen it either. And it feels like a thing that would be high up on the list of things that a guy like me would like. So I don't know. Where do you stand with him?
I have seen less than you. I've seen Narc, and I've seen The Gray, and I've seen all of the shorts from The Hire, all of those. So I've seen all those little things. But his very first film, Blood, Guts, Bullets, and Octane, I didn't see. I never saw the A-Team, and I've missed everything after The Gray. So I have just haven't seen much. And, you know, I like that he's somebody who's definitely keeping busy, but I feel like, I don't know, he's moved into a lot of things like Boss Level. I remember that coming out. It was like, I think, a straight to streaming. Hulu is where that went. And, you know, it was Frank Grillo was the lead. Mm-hmm. I think that he's moved into just a lot of the action genre straight up stuff. But I mean, Boss Level 6.8 on IMDb. Maybe it's worth checking out, you know?
Yeah, I think so too. I've got the trailer playing right now. It looks exhilarating. It looks exactly like the kind of good, like, punch him up fight, gives Frank Grillo a chance to do some awesome battle ready stuff.
Yeah.
No, it's interesting. Joe Carnahan. Like, I feel like, yeah, again, I know him better by name than by what I've seen.
I think that's it. But I don't know. I definitely think that he's got, like, when I see this film, it's just like, this film, every time I watch it, it's just higher and higher on my list of favorites. It's just such a fantastically crafted story that I feel like I should be seeing more of Carnahan's work.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we'll have to check some of these out, build it into a series or something.
Absolutely. Let's see if we can finagle Boss Level into next year. I'll bet, given how we're handling next year, I'll bet we can make it work.
We shall see. Let's see. We talked about cinematography. Any other elements that you want to talk about? Oh, the score. Mark Streitenfeld is a composer that I think I first recognized as one of those people who started working with Ridley Scott through kind of the Hans Zimmer machine. As one of those people kind of composing music out of that world. Like, his first job was working on A Good Year with Ridley Scott, and then American Gangster, Body of Lies, then Robin Hood, Prometheus. Like, he's done a lot of stuff with Ridley Scott. I think this score is so effective for this film. It's simple, but it's haunting. It's got some really creepy elements that work well, but I think it just... It's so perfect for helping tell this story. Like, it's not overwhelming, but I think it's just done very effectively.
Well, I will agree with all of that. I think it's very effective, and it marries with the overall sound design incredibly well. I think the way they use the sound of forest, and particularly the sound of wolves, in a way that's incredibly effective.
Yeah. Conveniently, he's also composed the music for 12 episodes of Raised by Wolves.
Oh. Excellent. There Doing great. It go. Worked.
Right. All right. Well, anything else from you?
No, that's it.
All right. Well, we'll be right back. But first, our credits.
The Next Reel is a production of True Story FM, engineering by Andy Nelson, music by Jordy Dalmau, Oriel Novella, and Eli Catlin. Andy usually finds all the stats for the awards and numbers at d-numbers.com, boxofficemojo.com, imdb.com, and wikipedia.org. Find the show at truestory.fm, and if your podcast app allows ratings and reviews, please consider doing that for our show. Andy, can you believe we've almost hit 700 episodes of The Next Reel?
I know, it's crazy. And with all the other episodes in our family of podcasts, we are well over 1,200 episodes of movie conversation. It's really pretty amazing that we've gotten to have these in-depth movie chats every week for over a decade now.
And we couldn't have done it without our loyal community of film fans. Their support over the years has meant so much.
For sure. That reminds me, we should give the merch store a shout-out. Buying shirts from thenextreel.com/merch is a great way listeners can continue to support the show. Plus, they get to sport our great designs.
Absolutely. I think sometimes folks forget we have a variety of shirts, mugs, phone cases, and more available. In fact, a great place to start is with a shirt sporting the Next Reel's logo.
We also have that classic Fast Times Spicoli Surf School tee, or the weirdly popular Rusty's European Tour shirt.
The one from National Lampoon's European Vacation. Why is that so popular?
Search me, but we have sold a ridiculous number of those. I guess there are a lot of Rusty's taking trips to Europe?
We're always adding new designs based on movies we've covered, like our brand new design for A Streetcar Named Desire, featuring a streetcar named Desire. So if you want to rep your love of TNR and films, head to thenextreel.com/merch.
Every purchase helps us continue to have these weekly in-depth conversations. So visit thenextreel.com/merch today.
And as always, thanks for listening and being a part of the Next Reel community. We've got lots more great movie chats coming your way. How to do it award season? Did you get anything? Best winter?
You know, it is one of those films that very much as a genre film, so it doesn't get the recognition that it likely deserved. It still had two wins with eight other nominations. At the Saturn Awards, the horror, sci-fi, and fantasy, it was nominated for best horror slash thriller film, but lost to David Fincher's The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. At the Golden Schmoes, it was nominated for Most Underrated Film of the Year, but lost at The Cabin in the Woods, which I don't know if I'd call that underrated.
Not at all.
Yeah.
It was
very rated. It was nominated for Best Surprise of the Year, but lost to 21 Jump Street. And Liam Neeson was nominated for Best Actor of the Year, but lost to Daniel Day-Lewis in Lincoln. At the Golden Trailer Awards, they have a red band trailer called Teeth that won the Best Thriller Trailer. And we're here because of the Fangoria Chainsaw Awards. This is, you know, the Fangoria Chainsaw Awards, Pete. They are a fun little award that Fangoria magazine started in 92 to provide an opportunity for more of horror kind of genre sorts of films to get recognized. And so that's why we're here. We're looking at the best actors. And Liam Neeson won Best Actor at the Fangoria Chainsaw Awards. It was nominated for Best Wide Release Film, but lost to The Cabin of the Woods. It was nominated for Best Score, but lost to Christopher Young for Sinister, which we'll be talking about in a few episodes from now. Frank Grillo was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, but lost to Fran Kranz in The Cabin in the Woods, which I don't remember which character that is in The Cabin in the Woods, but I just feel like Frank Grillo should have won. I thought he was so great in that. Do you remember who Fran Kranz is in that?
Fran Kranz was, isn't he the guy from Dollhouse? He was the odd man out in Cabin in the Woods with the redhead with the, and he talked real high like this.
I guess I don't remember. I need to watch that again.
Yeah. I like Frank Grant. He's good.
But would you pick him over Frank Grillo?
No, I would absolutely not pick him over Frank Grillo. All due respect to Frank Grant as a fan of Frank Grant. I feel like Frank Grillo has it.
Now here's a question for you. Liam Neeson, do you think that he was good enough to warrant an Oscar nomination? Here are the five nominees at the Oscars. You had Jean Dujardin from The Artist, who won, Brad Pitt in Moneyball, Demian Bashir in A Better Life, Gary Oldman in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and George Clooney in The Descendants. Should Liam Neeson have been in there? Would you take one of those out and put Liam Neeson in there?
No.
Really?
No. No, but Brad Pitt should have won for Moneyball. Everybody knows that. It's canonical truth. Science settled that.
I was going to say Gary Oldman should have won for Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, but I would take Jean Dujardin out.
Isn't it?
I would take Jean Dujardin out for The Artist, and I would put Liam Neeson in here.
I mean, it's fine, but I also wouldn't have him win.
That's because you have Brad Pitt for Moneyball. I know.
Brad Pitt for Moneyball.
You know
wins.
What? It's fine. It's fine.
Oh, so good.
Yeah, are you excited we're going to be talking about Moneyball again in a Movies We Like episode?
I am very excited to say that. Can I have more stars?
Now, here's a question for you. Frank Grillo, should he have been nominated for an Oscar? The options are Christopher Plummer, who won for Beginners, which I haven't seen, so I can't speak to that one. Jonah Hill for Moneyball, Kenneth Branagh for My Week with Marilyn, Max von Sydow in Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, and Nick Nolte in Warrior.
I don't know. I haven't seen all those.
I would take Kenneth Branagh out or Max von Sydow out and put Frank Grillo in. Absolutely.
And should he have won?
You know, maybe. I thought Jonah Hill was great in Moneyball, but I think a lot of that performance there was just because it seemed so different for Jonah Hill.
Totally.
I haven't seen Nick Nolte in Warrior, so I can't speak to that, but I heard he was great in it. Christopher Plummer, I heard was great in Beginners. This is a trickier one. Like, I'm just taking him, putting him in for one of the three that I've seen. I would be okay if he won, but again, I just haven't seen two of them.
What are you going to do?
I know.
All right. Is that it? Shall we talk about money?
Let's talk about money.
All right, let's talk about money.
Carnahan had a solid $25 million for his survival film, or $34.5 million in today's dollars. The movie premiered at the Butnumathon in December 2011, before having its wide release January 27, 2012, opposite One for the Money and Man on a Ledge. Clearly, it got caught in the January dumping ground, unfortunately. And, you know, probably why I missed it in the theaters. I saw the trailer and was just like, meh, I really regret that choice. But the fact that it was in the January dumping ground probably helped it take number one at the box office. It stayed in the top 10 for 4 weeks and went on to earn $51.6 million domestically and $29.7 million internationally for a total gross of $112.1 million in today's dollars. All told, that landed the film with an adjusted profit per finish minute of $663,000.
Do you want to try to resuscitate the Butnumathon? All the great films, none of the sexual assault and investigation. Just, how about that?
Right. All the fun, no Harry. Exactly. I did try getting into that once. In order to even go, you had to submit like essentially an essay sort of thing to be considered. It was kind of ridiculous. And of course I didn't get in, and I was like, well, screw you. I'm not going to try again. And I never did. And I never went. So there you go. I heard it was fun though.
Yeah.
I also acknowledge that I'm a person who has a hard time like staying up overnight. And I just imagine watching films 24 hours straight.
24 straight hours.
I probably would be somebody who would end up sleeping, and I would feel very guilty about that.
Yeah.
Oh, well, what are you gonna
do? I think it's perfect. Perfect for you. Let's do it. Next Reels Button Up.
Well, I love this film. This is one of my favorites, and it just gets better and better. And I'm glad you finally have seen it now.
Yeah, me too. Me too. It's really, really great. I enjoyed the heck out of it. So I'm in it.
Well, I'm curious where the rest of this series is going to go. So we'll be right back for our ratings. But first, here's the trailer for next week's movie, Ben Wheatley's Kill List.
One, two, three. Abracadabra.
People should suffer.
It is hard to believe we've been having in-depth weekly conversations about movies since 2011.
You're telling me producing this show week after week is so much fun, but it does require a lot of work behind the scenes. If you'd like to help support our efforts, one easy way is by using our Originals page when shopping for books and movies that we've covered.
Your purchases made through our links give us a small commission at no extra cost to you and allow us to keep having these great discussions.
The Originals page at thenextreel.com/originals links to the source material for all of our adapted film discussions. Purchasing through our links supports the show.
In season 13, we explore various awards categories and the films nominated in them.
We wrapped up our 1940 Best Picture series with adaptations of Mice and Men from John Steinbeck and Wuthering Heights from Emily Bronte's novel, not to mention the play Dark Victory by George Brewer Jr. and Bertram Block.
The 1947 Academy Award adapted screenplay series featured Anna and the King of Siam, based on Margaret Langdon's book, plus The Best Years of Our Lives, Brief Encounter, and The Killers.
The 1952 cinematography nominees included Death of a Salesman and A Streetcar Named Desire, A Place in the Sun, based on both a play and a book, and Strangers on a Train, based on Patricia Highsmith's first novel.
So many great movies based on books and plays, like Beckett, The Pumpkin Eater,
A Boy and His Dog, Rollerball,
The Princess Bride, Congo, The Scarlet Letter,
Jackie Brown, The Deep End, The Gray, The Woman in Black,
and Top Gun Maverick, which I'm very much looking forward to revisiting.
Get the source books at thenextreel.com/originals.
Start your next read or reread from the movies we've covered. Visit thenextreel.com/originals today. All right, Andy, it's Letterboxd time. I mean, is it a surprise where you're going with this? Would it surprise anybody? Where are the quibbles?
It shouldn't be a surprise. This film has zero quibbles for me. It is such a perfect film. It is haunting. It is devastating. It breaks my heart. I cry like at least three times in the film. It's just so solid of a film. I love what Carnahan did here. It's easy 5 stars and a heart for me.
I'm going to give it 5 stars and a heart. If I were a half star guy, I would give it 4.5 for my wife. That would be the half star of zip up your damn jackets and put your hood up. But I mean, she's not here and I'm not a half star guy. So 5 stars and a heart.
Wow. It might've got even another half star if your daughter is watching it with you, because being the wilderness expert that she is, I'm sure she would have had a few points as well.
Pissed.
Speaking of, we didn't even talk about the fact that there was a little bit of controversy when the film came out, because groups that hadn't seen it but knew that it was about wolves attacking, like I think it was was PETA and the Humane Society and Wild Earth Guardians, they started trying to boycott the film about the way that the wolves were being portrayed, and to the point where the production company was actually sending out fact sheets about the gray wolf on its website and everything. And so it's interesting. There is a very interesting marketing, because they actually got marketing with like religious groups on this film to push for people to come see it because of the philosophical and potentially religious angles that it took. Like, really strange.
Smart.
Well, yeah, it's just like, it was a surprise when I was reading that. I'm like, I guess I can see that, but I wouldn't have picked that.
Yeah, that's smart. So did any of the protesters actually ever see the movie, or did they just protest on principle?
It's one of these things. They protest on principle. I think like Sierra Club actually was working with the film. They must have actually seen it. Are the wolves necessarily going to do the things that they do in this film? I can't say. I don't know. But Carnahan would just respond to the criticism, say the film is meant to reflect humanity's internal spiritual journeys. And that was kind of his angle with them. So. And his wife, actually, after she saw it, she's like, oh, really interesting. So is he the only one there? Is it just Otway and all the other people are elements of his personality? And he and some of the other crew are like, what? Wow, we never even looked at it from that perspective. But that's fascinating. Like, what an interesting angle to take. A very Life of Pi angle.
Yeah. Like, what if he's the only survivor? Right. That's the other thing. That's a thing I was thinking, or maybe there is no wolf. Like, that's a real noodle baker.
Yeah, right. Like, there's a lot of different angles with this. So, yeah. Fascinating film. All right. Well, what did you think about The Gray? We would love to hear your thoughts. Hop into the Show Talk channel over in our Discord community, where we'll be talking about the movie this week.
When the movie ends,
our conversation begins.
Letterboxd giveth, Andrew.
As Letterboxd always doeth.
What kind of frigid reviews did you get this time?
I went with a 5-star by Ishmael Becerra, who had this to say, The Revenant, who are you? The Gray, I'm you, but better in every single imaginable way.
That's awesome. Oh, I've got 4.5 from Dumbsville, who says, me before watching The Gray. LMAO, funny, Alpha and Omega, but it's R-rated. Ha ha ha, LOL, LOL, LOL. Smiley face, so many emoji after watching The Gray. I have clinical depression. Oh, thanks, Letterboxd. Really good work this week.
I've been podcasting since 2006. In that time, I have tried countless hosting platforms, but in August 2022, we switched to Transistor to power all of our shows here at True Story FM, and it's been a game changer.
I love the Transistor allows unlimited podcasts and storage without extra charges. We can publish so much content, and we do. If you want to start up a podcast, do yourself a favor and host your show on Transistor.
With their one-click publishing, you can get your new show onto all the major podcast directories effortlessly.
And their website builder lets you quickly build custom sites for each show.
The detailed analytics are invaluable, too. You can access all kinds of listener data anytime.
Oh, and the versatile players allow you to embed episodes anywhere to reach new listeners. Plus, the team behind Transistor is super responsive and keeps making the platform even better.
After using countless hosting services over 15-plus years, Transistor has been, hands down, the best podcast partner for us.
If you want a hosting platform to take all the worry out of getting your podcast out into the world, go to thenextreel.com/transistor and check it out.
Support our show and support your own show by going to thenextreel.com/transistor. Start growing your podcast today.